You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about the health benefits of singing. First, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism just released the most recent story in their Failure at the Faucet series, which looks at drinking water quality in the state. In this new installment, the focus is on lead and copper in the drinking water at two Wisconsin correctional facilities and the impact on both inmates and prison employees. Joining us to discuss the findings is Dee Hall. She's the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and the author of the new piece. Dee, welcome back to the show.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You focus on two prisons in the article, the Fox Lake and the Waupun Correctional Institutions. Just give us a quick view of those facilities.
So Fox Lake has had some problems. Both institutions have had some lead and copper problems at least since 2008, according to the DNR database. Fox Lake is about a 55-year-old prison. Pond's very old. It's 150 years old. So it's got a lot of old components in it. But both of them are having lead and copper problems in the drinking water.
Yeah, talk about what findings are out there. How bad is the problem with lead and copper in these facilities?
So the story was initiated because inmates had come to me with concerns about the quality of the Fox Lake water. They reported that it was brown or yellow. It had a lot of sediment in it. It had a bad flavor, a bad odor. And so I began looking at that and then discovered in the course of my reporting that Waupun, in fact, also has had some problems with lead and copper. So that's how the stories got started. I did look at other prisons, but it's very difficult to find problems at other prisons if they don't run their own water systems. These two prisons happen to run their own water systems.
What kind of health concerns are we talking about? Lead, I think people are pretty familiar with, but copper, what kind of problems come with copper?
Well, lead has different effects in adults than children. I think people are pretty aware of the cognitive problems with lead in children. But in adults, it can cause lowered immunity, kidney failure, gout, high blood pressure, and nerve damage. Copper has other effects. It can cause nausea, abdominal pain, diarrhea, and vomiting. And very high levels can create kidney and liver damage. So these do have harmful effects on adults. We just don't talk about them as much because the main concern, especially with lead, is children and brain development.
Who is responsible for maintaining the water supply, for testing, if there is testing, for things like lead and copper at these correctional facilities?
Well, each of the facilities runs its own water system. And water systems across the state, any such water system must regularly test for lead and copper in the water. And then beyond that, then they have some responsibilities if they're not able to meet, if 90% of their samples are not able to meet the federal standards, then they must take some steps, including public education about how to reduce the amount of lead in the water, and then in some cases to do some physical fixes, some changes to lower the hazard of lead and copper.
Have we seen either of these things happen at Fox Lake or Waupun, either that educational effort or remediation, trying to fix the problem?
We have seen both at both prisons. So at Fox Lake, for example, they closed down one of their water wells and they made fixes to three others. Apparently, there were some lead components in the wells themselves. They're also working on getting some water treatment going there. The water treatment is aimed at avoiding corrosion in the pipes, which is what sends lead and copper into the water. Waupun already is doing some water treatment itself. And so there have been steps taken at both institutions, and Fox Lake's problems, which are a little more severe and longer standing, they're under consent order from the State Department of Natural Resources to bring the levels down as soon as they can.
And on the educational side, have the facilities alerted staff and inmates about how to run the water?
Well, we are aware that they have definitely notified the inmates at Fox Lake. They were all notified. All of the 13 who wrote to me were notified of the problems. At Waupun, it was a mixed picture. The state said it did notify the staff in 2014 and I believe inmates were aware of this when they had some high levels, but one of the top correctional officer association members said he does not recall being notified of that in 2014. there were higher levels again in 2015, and he did say that he recalls being notified of that in last fall.
Talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about the latest in the failure at the faucet series, looking at water quality, this installment in a couple of Wisconsin prisons. Let's talk about the two groups of people affected by the water quality. There's the prisoners, there's the people who work there. Starting with the prisoners, do they have any kind of option to access other sources of drinking water if they're worried about the quality of the water in their prison?
The inmates can purchase bottled water at the canteen. One of the prisoners who wrote to me said that it costs about $7.50 for a case of water. He indicated, however, that that was very overpriced, and I did check that, and it is about twice the cost of what you can get a case of bottled water at a place like Woodman's. So they can always purchase it. Some who can't afford it, however, have use a variety of strategies, including running the water, letting it sit in a cup, and letting the sediment fall out of it, and then just drinking the top part of the glass.
And you heard from inmates who work in the kitchens at these facilities.
There was one inmate who worked in the kitchen. He was very concerned about using the water for cooking. Boiling water with lead in it can concentrate the effects of lead. Unlike if you have bacteria in your water and you have a boil water order, that can help you with bacteria, but with lead in it, unfortunately, concentrates it. So we did hear about that as well.
And then the prison employees are there. They're drinking potentially the same water.
Now, they can bring their own water in, and they do what the gentleman who I interviewed, who's one of the top correctional officials in the state, for correctional officers, one of the top guards in the state, indicated to me that there is a limit on how much they can carry in at each prison, and he felt that that's something that should be adjusted to account for the fact that the water may not be safe at various times.
In the piece, you quote a Department of Corrections spokesperson saying the Fox Lake Correctional Institution water system is following all state and federal requirements of the Safe Drinking Water Act to provide safe water for staff, inmates, and visitors to use for drinking, cooking, and bathing. That's their take on this?
Right. So our earlier stories on lead revealed that the existing lead and copper rule, which is 25 years old now, really does not protect public health, unfortunately. It was designed to identify system-wide problems, but not to zero in on hot spots where there might be a problem. And the reason is because the amount of lead or copper in your water is influenced by the kind of plumbing you have in your home and the way you use water. For example, if you run hot water out of the tap, that's going to have more lead in it than if you run cold water out of your tap. How quickly you run it, whether you run it for a while after it sits in the pipes for 6 hours. So there's all kinds of variables. And frankly, the lead and copper rule is not designed and does not account for levels, high levels that could be happening all the time in systems that have lead.
As we wrap up, do you think that things will get better, that there are steps being taken that will improve water quality at these two prisons?
Well, right now at Fox Lake, they are under a legal agreement with the DNR that they need to lower these lead and copper levels. So I assume that that will be enforced, that they will have to come into compliance. They are going to also install more regular metals monitoring there that would, I would presume, would allow them to have more real-time data on how safe the water is as it's coming out of the tap.
And what's next for the people there at those prisons? They're stuck drinking the water they got, I guess.
Yes, unless they purchase some at the canteen. I will say that some of the prisoner advocates are pretty upset about this. They were among the people who also alerted me to the problem, and I think they're going to be calling for some other steps, some more provision of water for inmates that they don't have to buy and steps like that.
Dee, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me.
That's Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She's the author of a new report looking at water quality in two Wisconsin prisons. It's the newest piece in the Failure at the Faucet series. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at your favorite children's books of all time on the 100th birthday of legendary children's author Beverly Cleary. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Will Hooverman loves to sing. He's a sophomore at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and balances school with music, performing in the a cappella group The Mad Hatters, as well as writing and recording his own music.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Running you away.
My name is Will Hooverman, a sophomore here, studying poli-sci and journalism. I'm in an all-male a cappella group here called the Mad Hatters.
Rhythm. So when we're doing, can we run it one more time?
My friend Dex Barstad, who is doing a lot of production work around the Twin Cities for different artists, rappers. The Trotsky to my Lennon, so to speak. He sort of does all of the back end as far as production and everything. So that's who I'm collaborating with mainly, along with another few other engineers and producers. But yeah, we just finished tracking my first studio EP. It's called Pressure. We were working at Winterland Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's where I grew up, so I was able to connect with some people there.
I guess this is like all the tracks before they've gotten like finally officially produced. I actually loved them. Like, I thought they were really good. I was really impressed with his just the quality of his work.
My mom's best friend, they went to high school, college, and law school together. Unfortunately, a couple years back, her dad passed away, and they asked me to perform at his funeral, something I'd never done before. You know, I had done performances around the community, but nothing of that sort of weight and magnitude. So I performed there. I did like sort of like a hymnal, and after the funeral, his wife, who survived him, came up to me and was, you know, in tears and thanking me so much for coming to perform. And I was just, that was just really striking for me, because I realized, you know, that was something in that moment I figured I could use maybe music and singing to really convey a message and convey emotion. And that was really just a striking sort of existential moment for me. So yeah, that was really one of those milestone moments where you look back on it and be like, I think that was a moment where things sort of changed. Honestly, the human voice for me is probably the most powerful instrument in all of music. I think each voice carries a different timbre, like a different tone that can't be, you know, conveyed in any other way. Yeah, when I was younger, I remember something that always stuck with me. My grandma would say, as you go off to school and think about what you want to do with your life, just make sure that you love what you're doing. Because when you look back on this time, if you don't love it, you're wasting your time. I mean, you only get one shot at this thing we call life. And if you're not constantly loving what you do every day, then quit your job. Then think about something else. So my biggest piece of advice for people who have a musical goal of any kind, or, you know, you want to be a painter, you want to be anything with a creative form, you know, make sure that whatever you're doing, you love it.
The story was produced by AJ Garcia for the Storytelling Through Sound class at UW-Madison. Hooverman's new album, Pressure, comes out this spring. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org. We'll keep on singing now. We've heard about recent studies showing that singing, especially singing with other people, can deliver health benefits, including reduced heart rate and social and emotional benefits along with that. Joining us now to talk more about the benefits and the fun of singing is Stephanie Elkins. She's a singer, musician, and a regular voice here at WPR Morning Classics, a longtime Simply Folk host. Stephanie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, were you surprised to hear that singing turns out to have all these benefits? We've talked to you about this a little bit before. No surprise to you, I'm guessing.
Not surprised, no. And I think I must have known subconsciously all the time, but what's shocking is how many of these scientific studies are coming out one after another. And you talked about the heart rate lowering, and there are studies now that singers, especially singers who sing in choral groups and with others, have lower stress levels, lower cortisol. It releases oxytocin, which helps with anxiety. There are all these wonderful benefits of singing.
Yeah, I don't sing a lot, and usually I sing alone where no one else is there. It seems like a lot of this benefit is singing as a social activity, though. This is something that you've done a fair amount.
Yeah, I have over the years, off and on, and I think there's a lot of components to it. One is that if you're singing with a group, it gets you out of the house, you go, and you're with other people, you belong to something larger than yourself. In many cases, you're needed, you feel like you're relied upon, and you're listening to each other, you're creating something very intimate in yourself, in your body. It comes out of you, and then you're sharing it with all these other people, and it's very deep. It's wonderful.
Now, I'll say, as someone who's not a great singer, I'm a musician. I play instruments. I sing usually only for comedic impact, though. I personally, and I think a lot of people are in this camp, find it a little intimidating if we're not good singers to get out there and sing with other people. What's your advice on getting out there and making that start, even if we're not, you know, pros with awesome voices?
I think there are a lot of things you can do. There are so many groups that don't require auditions that are just for fun, and you can find those through universities, and there are sometimes summer groups that come together. You can start your own. I mean, you can find friends or people that just ask them to get together and sing a little bit, sing in the car with family and friends. I mean, there are all kinds of ways of getting those benefits without having to be, you know, a professional singer who's a perfect sight singer and all that.
Yeah, I think with a lot of art or any kind of creativity, we've become a culture that leaves it to the experts. And yeah, the experts are good and they do a lot of great stuff. How can we start to reclaim that as a social activity?
You know, that's a great point, Rob. If you think about before the advent of radio and TV and internet and everything, that's what everybody did. It didn't matter if you were good or not. You either learned to sing, or you played fiddle, or you played piano, and that's what you did for entertainment. And it made you feel good. And now we sit as passive. We absorb music and we look at other people dancing, and, you know, it's just not quite right. So how can we do that? I think we have to make a point of bringing it into our lives, finding opportunities or creating opportunities.
Well, people who go to church have kind of an easy in here. I remember growing up, and I had a set of grandparents now passed away. My grandma, excellent singer in the choir. My grandpa, Lord love him, awful voice. We fought over and he belted it out. He had a lot of fun with it. You heard him throughout the whole church. But that's a great, church is not going to be a judgy place. Is that part of the key, that it's a non-judgmental space to sing?
Absolutely. And the whole congregation can pitch in, so you're a little bit protected. Uh-huh. And and church is, that's where I started too. I mean, as a kid, I sang in church choir and learned a lot of harmony singing that way. I can remember first looking at notes as a little kid and realizing there was a, you know, how it worked, that if the note went up, your voice went up. I mean, it's a neat way to start, but there are a lot of singing groups that are not connected to any kind of spiritual tradition. I think I read that there are about 300,000 in the States, and there are a lot of resources to be able to find those.
Talking to Stephanie Elkins, a WPR host, singer and musician herself, about the benefits of singing, the benefits of singing together with other people, too. When did you first know that, hey, the singing thing, it's a fun thing?
Well, I was one of those that, my dad was in the Army, so I grew up in all kinds of places, and I didn't have a lot of friends because I was always moving every couple of years, but I could always join the choir, always join the chorus, and instantly have a connection with others. And that, I think, was probably part of it for me. And then in college, starting to feel that real stress, like we just heard in the Wisconsin Life piece, I always managed to take some kind of a singing, you know, chorus or choir or madrigals or something like that, and that was like my therapy before I even knew about therapy. That was my therapy.
Well, in that Wisconsin Life piece, we heard that singer/student talking about, you know, the life advice to always be doing something you love. Realistically, in the job world, you can't always be there. You're not always going to be doing something you love. But singing, you don't have to pay to do it. That's, you can incorporate that into your life and have and be doing something you love, even if it's not your career right now.
That's right. You can use it for stress relief. You can use it for social bonding. It, as you mentioned, is very affordable. It's free in many cases. And you can have it as an avocation. As, you know, that word amateur means to love. It comes from the root of the word to love. And so you're bringing in something that you love that enhances all the other areas of your life. I mean, I find that the weeks that I miss singing, if I'm not singing that week, somehow the week is not flowing as well. I mean, it really makes a difference in all aspects of your life.
Now, I understand you've recently gotten back into singing more regularly. Have you noticed a change? Are you feeling happier and healthier?
Yeah, you know, I made a New Year's resolution that I was going to be singing with others this year, and I finally did. I joined a local choir, and I am noticing a difference. It's the same thing. It had been at least 10 years since I've sung regularly, and I feel so great, almost elated. I would say almost kind of high as a kite sometimes.
That oxytocin's really kicking
yeah,
in.
That's right. It's healthier than alcohol. It's healthier than, you know, some of the other ways that we relieve stress. And I go home feeling fantastic. And I think it does bleed into other areas of my life anyway. I think it helps me with stress relief and dealing with times that are overwhelming and those challenges in life that every single one of us has to face.
Well, briefly, as we wrap up, Stephanie, for the people out there listening, thinking, yeah, maybe, can you nudge them over the edge to get out and sing?
You can nudge. I wouldn't force, but you can you can nudge. And I find that just showing a good example of being happy when you're singing and encouraging other people to sing with you without trying to force, but just being really comfortable with what you're doing, all of a sudden more people are joining in. I've seen that happen in families with shy kids, and it really works by attraction very well.
Well, you, me, and Michelle had worked out this fine three-part harmony, but we're just out of time. We're not going to be able to get it in there. Maybe next time. Stephanie, thanks, as always.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
Stephanie Elkins is a singer, musician, a host of Morning Classics on WPR, longtime Simply Folk host. Coming up after the news, children's author Beverly Cleary turns 100 tomorrow. We'll talk about Ramona, Beezus, and all of the kids of Klickitat Street and how the children's author changed the reading scene for kids everywhere. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up after 7, it's today's edition of Reveal. Today, Reveal tells the stories of children crossing borders alone in Asia, Europe, Africa, and here in the United States. You'll hear about the wars they're fleeing, where they're trying to go, and what happens when they get there. First, if you think back to when you were a kid, you probably have some strong sentimental feeling toward your favorite books. Maybe you read with your parents every night or loved how a teacher acted out your favorite characters. Maybe you even read under the covers with that flashlight after it was time to go to sleep. One author who blazed a trail for young readers was Beverly Cleary, best known for her beloved Ramona and Beezus books. In an interview with NPR in 2006, this is what Cleary had to say about the genesis of her writing career and her stories about the kids of Klickitat Street.
I know that when I was a children's librarian, that was about 1940, boys particularly asked where were the books about kids like us, and there weren't any at that time.
On the eve of Beverly Cleary's 100th birthday, we wanted to pay homage to the author and how she helped shift the literary landscape for children. Joining us now is Kathleen Horning. She's director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center at UW-Madison. Kathleen, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'd like to celebrate Beverly Cleary's 100th birthday.
Yeah, well, and let's talk about her career a little bit. As we just heard, she was a librarian before becoming an author. What led her to make that change?
Well, she had an awareness of what was being published for children at that time and what kinds of things children like to read. And she also had an awareness of what wasn't out there and decided that she would try her hand at writing to see if she could write the sorts of books that kids actually wanted to read. And she sure did.
Yeah, what was it about the books that she wrote? What was she trying to do that would make kids actually want to read these books?
Well, I think one of the things she was so skilled at doing, and her earlier books, before Beezus and Ramona, she wrote books such as Ellen Tibbetts and Otis Spofford. Those are some of her really early books. And then she wrote about a character called Henry Huggins. And Beezus was one of his friends, and then it extended to from there. But I think what she was doing was writing about real kids who fought with their siblings, kids who didn't always act in a perfect manner. And in fact, the fact that her character Ramona, who actually started out as a secondary character, became so popular with children because she was such a pest and she was a bothersome little sister, she really just took over the series. And I think it was because children identified so much with her.
What was the state of the art at the time when she started trying to write this way? Was it model children or really boring stuff like the Dick and Jane books?
Well, the Dick and Jane books were the readers. They were what the Basils that we were all learning to read out of. Mm. But there was a lot of fiction being written for children, but a lot of it, I think, did deal with model children, or as one librarian put it, tales of sunny childhood. And that there wasn't always a lot of real-world conflict in the books. There was narrative conflict, but not the kind of conflict where you're fighting tooth and nail with your siblings like Beverly Cleary's characters do.
Well, since she was, in a way, establishing a new paradigm, did she have pushback? Were people not wanting to publish what she wrote? Was there criticism of talking about conflict among kids?
You know, I don't know that she did get pushback because, excuse me, her books were so incredibly popular. And another thing that she did was write really readable books, books that were easy for children in third grade to read. For many children in my era, and I was reading these books myself when I was in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. So kids who were growing up in the 50s and 60s, they often were the first chapter books they read on their own. I don't think there was really any pushback against Beverly Cleary because children's literature at that time was changing, and she helped to usher in a new era of children's books that really reflected more the real lives of children.
Did a lot of other authors, and I guess publishers for that matter, look specifically at her works and say, ah, this is working, this has kids reading, and model themselves after that?
She certainly did have a lot of imitators, and actually I think still does. There are a number of series that are just being published today, such as the Judy Moody series, for mm-hmm. example, or the Alvin Ho series, that can be traced back to Beverly Cleary's books.
We're talking to Kathleen Horning with the Cooperative Children's Book Center at UW-Madison. Tomorrow is children's author Beverly Cleary's 100th birthday, and we're looking at her influence on children's literature. In a little bit, we'll ask for some of your favorites at 800-642-1234. Your favorite kids' books by Beverly Cleary or other authors for that matter. Is her method in a way showing respect for kids, like acknowledging the reality that childhood isn't all fun and games and moral uplift, that it is rough and contentious?
Yeah, I think that she really did reflect the kinds of lives that kids were really leading, and that's why they connected so much. One of the things that's really interesting, I think, about the character Ramona and Beezus as well, her sister, is that they were books that were enjoyed by, and still are, enjoyed by all kinds of children. Both boys and girls read about Ramona and Beezus.
I did, yeah.
And there recently was, actually the current issue of Hornbook Magazine is a tribute issue to Beverly Cleary, and they have a number of authors and in some cases illustrators writing about what it was, their own love of Beverly Cleary from when they were young. And there are just as many male authors as there are female authors. And one of the authors, a man named Varian Johnson, who's African-American, who talks about how he connected so much with Beezus and Ramona when he was young.
I read an interview with her, a very recent one, I think, because of her 100th birthday coming up, where she said she didn't make a point of having a moral lesson, a moral at the end of the story. Was that part of the key to her success?
I think so. I think children are very sensitive to when they feel like they're being preached at, and they know when a book is entertaining and when someone's trying to teach them something. And I think that the Beverly Cleary's books do have a really strong moral center, mm-hmm. But they're not trying to teach amoral, so to speak, if that makes sense. I think that she writes about, particularly the character Ramona is a unique character, but she's also universal, and I think that's why so many children have connected with her over the generations.
What are some of your other favorite characters that she created? Ramona and Beezus are as you say, the most famous ones, but what are some of her other great creations?
Well, she created a character, Ralph the Mouse, who rode a motorcycle, mm-hmm. and he was, in some cases, he was the character that first got kids reading Beverly Cleary, and then they went on to read others. I remember reading Ellen Tibbetts when I was young, and that was the first Beverly Cleary book that I read, and she was just kind of an ordinary little girl who, as I recall, was taking ballet lessons and worried about things like itchy socks and being uncomfortable in the ballet clothes and that sort of thing. And, you know, I haven't gone back and reread Ellen Tibbetts since I read it as a child, but I still clearly remember aspects of that story.
Sometimes for adult fiction, things seem really attached to their time. They're great at that moment. Mm-hmm. Looking back, not so good. Do you think Beverly Cleary stands up now as well as she did when she first wrote it?
I think she does. There are some things in her book that in her books that are dated, that are products of their time. But the characters themselves and the interactions between them are timeless. They do come out periodically with new illustrations in updated editions, so they look like modern children. But just for an example, one of the writers in this Hornbook magazine was talking about episode in a Beverly Cleary book where Ramona wrote all over her sister's autograph book. She signed every page. Mm-hmm. And autograph books really aren't something that kids have today, but it's something that kids today still understand. Mm-hmm. They understand the concept of it. So they still do seem to relate to her books. And this same librarian took an informal poll among the kids in her reading group and found that they all had read Beverly Cleary and they all loved Beezus and Ramona.
You mentioned that a lot of modern-day children's authors are inspired in one way or another by Beverly Cleary. I want to turn to some of the modern authors. Who mm-hmm. do you look at now and see having that same impact on kids, the same love of reading them by kids?
Well, I think today's modern-day Ramona is, aside from Ramona herself, is Judy Moody, a series written by Megan McDonald. And she has that same sort of... she's a kid who's not perfect, and children reading about her identify with her. And like the Beverly Cleary Ramona books, they're very easy to read chapter books, and they are in a series. And that also seems to be an important feature of Beverly Cleary's books, that a child will read one of the books in the series, and then there'll be many others that they can go through. There's a familiar character. Alvin Ho is a series by an author named Lenore Look, and he is a Chinese-American kid, and he is like very much like Ramona. He's always kind of getting into trouble. It's really funny. It's this neighborhood of friends that that he plays with, and they're just all kinds of the stories are episodic in that, you know, there's one event and a chapter, and that finishes up, and then it starts another. So you're not following a narrative arc from the beginning of the book to the end. Mm.
We're talking to Kathleen Horning, director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center at UW-Madison. She's with us to talk about children's books, how they've changed, evolved since author Beverly Cleary began writing for children in 1950. Beverly Cleary turns 100 years old tomorrow. We want to hear from you. What was your favorite children's book growing up? If you have kids, how are their books different than the ones you had, or the ones you share from your childhood with the next generation? How important is reading to children in the age of the internet and tablets? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about children's books and children's author Beverly Cleary and how she shaped the literary landscape for young readers. She turns 100 tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has Beverly Cleary and have Ramona and Beezus touched your life? What was your favorite book as a child? How do you celebrate reading with maybe with your kids today? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kathleen Horning stays with us. She's director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center at the School of Education at UW-Madison. We'll go to our callers now with Whitney in Verona. Whitney, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call because I loved Beverly Cleary growing up, and an author that I found as a mother and teacher who has brought my children through early childhood up to adolescence is Kate DeCalmo. And she writes great books for children of all ages, including Mercy Watson to Inkspell for older kids.
Kate DeCamillo, actually, she lives in Minneapolis, so she's not too far
from
here.
A local almost, yeah.
Yeah, almost a local author. And I agree. I think she is just an absolutely fine author. And as you say, she writes a range of things from the beginning readers series like Mercy Watson and Bink and Golly to novels for older kids. She's won the Newbery Medal twice, and she's only been writing, I think, maybe for only about 15 years. So, and she was just recently the children's literature ambassador for the entire nation. So, yes, I agree. And if there are any listeners out there who haven't yet discovered Kate DeCamillo, I highly recommend that they check out her books.
Whitney, thanks for the call. That's impressive to be able to write and target different age groups and mm-hmm. to be able to do it successfully.
Yes, absolutely.
Back to our callers. Thanks, Whitney. We've got Julia on the line in Madison now. Julia, hi.
Thank you for having me on. Robert McCluskey has been one of my favorites that I've enjoyed even before I had kids, and then I got to introduce them to him as well. And one thing that is big for me, whether it's his books, One Day in Maine or Blueberries for Sale, to me is the illustrations of a children's book. I just think, you know, some artists have that knack of really drawing kids in and adults in, and I think he really did a fabulous job with his books.
And you were nodding along there, Kathleen.
I am. You know, and it's funny. When I was a child, I always associated Robert McCloskey's books with Beverly Cleary's, and I think his illustrations have that same element of realism that I was so hungry for as a child reading children's books. I remember in one of the illustrations in One Morning in Maine, the little sister has spilled, she's sitting in her high chair and she's spilled her milk, and the cat is on the floor licking the spilled milk. It's not in the scene at all, it's not in the text, but it's just one of the details in the story. And his characters might, you know, have their shoes untied or have their hair messed up. They felt to me very much like they lived in the same universe as Beezus and Ramona.
Thank you so much for that, Julia. You can join in with your favorite children's books, your favorite memories of reading as a kid, or to your kid or to your students at 800-642-1234. Beverly Cleary celebrates her 100th birthday tomorrow, looking at her work and children's writing in general. Back to our callers now with Mary Ann on the line in La Crosse. Mary Ann, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to, make two comments, and one is that I completely agree with the prior caller about the importance of quality illustrations and story. The books that I tend to read my five-year-old are rich in illustrations, and they are older books. They're not the most contemporary children's books. One of my favorite to read him this time of year is The Story of the Root Children, which is by Sybil von Ulfers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's written in like 1902 or something.
Oh, wow.
But it's a wonderful story of the changing of the season and the waking up of spring. And I really gravitate toward the books that are really rich in the oral tradition of storytelling, even though it's written. And then the text, the illustrations match the quality of the storytelling. A lot of the books, if I go to Barnes & Noble with my son, you know, press this button here, or certain books are so simplistically illustrated that I feel like a lot of newer children's book authors are trying to kind of skip over the need to have excellent illustrations.
And Marianne, thanks a lot for the call. Kathleen, can you give us some recent books with really solid illustrations so we don't need to necessarily go back to 1902?
Oh, well, you know, there are some great books that were published in 1902 that are still around. But I understand the type of books that Marianne's talking about that she sees when she goes to Barnes & Noble, such as, you know, what I think of as kind of gimmicky mm-hmm. books. But there are a lot of books that have been published recently that are more akin to the ones that you're talking about from 1902 than the gimmicky books. I would say books by Kevin Henkes, for example, and he does kind of a range of books as well. Like Kate DiCamillo, he does picture books for very young children, picture books for slightly older children, and then he writes children's novels as well. And he, too, is a Madison author. He's a local author-illustrator. And I always forget until I leave Madison how famous Kevin is around the world. People know him everywhere. But I think that, you know, what I would recommend is trying to go to your public library. The La Crosse Public Library is absolutely fantastic. And I'm sure that you'll be able to find a lot of really great books for your children that that you like as much as the Root children.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marianne. We'll go next to Joanne in Petoskey. Joanne, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to add, I adore Cynthia Ryland. She writes the Henry and Mudge series and Mr. Putter and Tabby series, as well as she has several others, too.
Several, yes. I think she has about 100 others.
Wow.
Yeah. She's very prolific.
Yes, she's extremely prolific. Adorable illustrations. She has several board books, and she writes for a wide range of audiences, from very early to young adults.
Joanne, thanks for that suggestion. Cynthia Ryland was the name?
Cynthia Ryland, yes. And just as Joanne said, it seems to be a theme here that we are appreciating the authors who write for the very youngest and going up through childhood. Not everyone can do that, but Cynthia Ryland is certainly one who can.
Well, can you leave us with a little encouragement, ways that parents can read more with their kids, get their kids ultimately to read more themselves?
Well, you know, I always think reading aloud to children is a great thing. Sometimes people stop reading aloud to their children once their children learn to read. And I really encourage parents to keep reading chapter books to children well after they learn to read. And if you have more than one child, to find some good chapter books in your public library can help you do this, that will appeal to the range of ages of your own children. And really just read. Make it a habit. Read during breakfast or before bedtime, but try to read a little bit at least each day.
And do you think that in an age of technology, just briefly, are we still doing it? Are we still reading to our kids?
Oh, absolutely. You don't have to have an either or. You can have it all.
Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Kathleen Horning. She's director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center at the School of Education at UW-Madison. She joined us today to talk about the impact that Beverly Cleary has had on the world of children's literature ahead of that author's 100th birthday tomorrow. You can still share your favorite children's books, your favorite reading memories as a kid or to a kid. You can head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. Share your suggestions with us.